You are listening to local and regional news produced by KMUN with help from our news partners. I'm Skylar Butenchin.
It's Wednesday, December 3rd. The Owens 2, an affordable housing project in downtown Astoria that has long been in the works, is on track to open next spring. The Northwest Oregon Housing Authority's new 50-unit complex is right next to its existing Owens Adair building. Construction was delayed on the Owens 2 several times due to differing opinions over geotechnical issues and concerns about potential landslides. The Housing Authority says it anticipates residents will be able to begin moving into the Owens 2 on April 1, 2026. A waitlist is expected to open between January and February, and more information will be posted soon on the agency's website. According to Northwest Oregon Housing Authority Marketing Coordinator Anna Kornfeld, all rents of the Owens 2 will be at or below 60% of the area median income. Kornfeld says the development comes at a critical moment as the region continues to face high housing costs and rising homelessness. Clatsop Community Action will staff an on-site resource desk at Owens 2, offering residents help with basic needs support, programs, and services. A community tour of the Owens 2 project will happen on Thursday, February 12th, from 4 to 6 p.m. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian. Read more online at dailyastorian.com. Work is well underway at the Spruce Point affordable apartment complex in Manzanita, and it's on pace to open next fall. The new 60-unit development is being led by Home First Development Partners and supported by grants from Oregon Housing and Community Services and the Tillamook County Affordable Housing Grant Program. Construction crews broke ground on the Spruce Point complex back in August. The apartments will be affordable to residents earning 60% of the area's median income or less, with 12 units dedicated to those earning 30% of that figure or less. And the complex will feature a community center with a leasing office and community area, as well as a common courtyard with a nautically themed playground. Tillamook Bay Community College is facing a challenging financial situation because of many factors, leading President Paul Jarrell to begin considering cost-cutting measures for the institution. Jarrell says the biggest factor is the budget crunch at the state government. Oregon's August revenue forecast projected a roughly $373 million state deficit for the current biennium, given the current budget. And state funding accounts for about 60% of Tillamook Bay Community College's operating budget. Another financial challenge for the college, which currently has 65 full-time employees, is the increase in its contributions to employees' pensions. Jarrell says that as part of the cost reduction exercise, college leaders have decided to implement a hiring freeze in anticipation of the projected need for cuts. And he says they'll also have to put a hiatus on non-essential travel. While Jarrell estimates those changes will save several hundred thousand dollars, he says any further reductions would likely mean eventually cutting staff positions. Jarrell says he and other administrators at the college will look at ways to combine and streamline positions to continue delivering the most important programs and services for students. These stories come to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. Six rural hospitals in Oregon and Washington have closed their obstetrics units since 2020. Providence Hospital in Seaside, Oregon, is the latest to do so. For the Northwest News Network, Rachel Miller Howard reports on why it's so hard to keep labor and delivery units open, and what happens after they're gone.
In Seaside, Oregon, Heather Murdoch-Medema is packing up her apartment.
All of the boxes that have pink on them, those are just set to go to storage right away.
Murdoch-Medema is a labor and delivery nurse. In 2023, she got a job at the Providence Hospital Obstetrics Unit in Seaside, population 7,000. But in August, she got the news that the unit would close in early October. Murdoch-Medema says she worries for her patients, Some didn't have transportation and walked to their prenatal appointments.
Maybe it was a really rainy day and they come in drenched and you're sort of like, why are you so wet? And they're like, oh, I walk here.
Labor and delivery wards across the country are shuttering. Here in the Pacific Northwest, Seaside Providence is just the latest.
The pregnant folks in our state, where I'm adjusting to a new reality.
Christine Bell is the executive director for Providence Women and Children's Services in Oregon. She says the decision to close the unit was a numbers game.
What's common, particularly in Oregon, is a declining birth rate.
The birth rate in Oregon fell by around 22% in the last decade, in Washington by around 18%. At its peak in 2015, Seaside was delivering 120 babies per year. In 2024, that number was 66. There were also personnel challenges.
We had recruited for a number, almost 2 years had been recruiting to replace an obstetrician and just didn't get any candidates.
Bell says staffing challenges were the primary driver, but the profit loss was significant. 65% of patients were on Medicaid.
And Medicaid does not cover our costs. And so we lose money on every single one of those deliveries.
Ashley Stoneburner is the director of Applied Research and Analytics at March of Dimes, a nonprofit that works to improve the health of mothers and babies. She says these are common reasons for rural labor and delivery closures.
We know that if you live far from your provider during pregnancy, you may not make your appointments for your prenatal care, which puts you at risk for poor birth outcomes.
Christine Bell says patients can still come into Seaside for their prenatal care, but they will have to decide where they want to give birth.
Hi.
Are you Abby?
Yes,
I am. Abby Reed lives in Wheeler, Oregon, 30 minutes south of Seaside. Reed is due February 1st. She gave birth to her first daughter at Seaside in 2024. She wanted an unmedicated birth and said the hospital respected her wishes.
Post-labor, there were complications. I hemorrhaged, so I lost a lot of blood.
Postpartum hemorrhage can lead to shock and death of the mother if left untreated. When she found out she was pregnant again this past May, Seaside was the obvious choice. But then she got the news.
I was super blindsided. I was like, can they do that? Like, can a hospital do that?
Her options were Adventist Health in Tillamook, about 30 minutes south, a home birth in Wheeler, Columbia Memorial Hospital in Astoria, or the Astoria Birth Center. Reed chose the birth center. Even though it's further, she trusted them.
For me, birth was kind of a sacred experience, like a really empowering thing to go through. I knew that the birth center would definitely support me in all that.
The center is staffed by midwives. It's 30 minutes north of Seaside, up 101. And for Reed, it's an hour. On a stormy Friday morning, I drove her route myself, through half a dozen small coastal towns on the edge of the Pacific, to meet Rebecca Orton, the owner of the Astoria Birth Center.
One's a large birth room on the other side of this door, and one, two, is a smaller birth room on the other side of this wall.
The center serves families from all over Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington. She says her staff can handle 15 births a month. Currently, they're nowhere near that.
We could comfortably absorb the entire clientele that Providence was seeing.
A spokesperson for Columbia Memorial Hospital in Astoria said they also have capacity to absorb patients. Rural labor and delivery care is caught in a vicious cycle. Birth rates are declining. Staffing small units in small places is challenging. Labor and delivery care is expensive, so they're often the department hospitals shutter first. I asked Abby Reed if she's worried about an emergency on her drive to Astoria. She said she isn't.
My husband and I, we're Christians. We believe in God. And so I feel like in those types of moments, we just surrender it. And we trust that it'd be okay.
In Seaside, Oregon, I'm Rachel Miller Howard.
This is KMUN News. A state senator wants Oregonians to sign liability waivers before they hop on a ski lift, raft with a guide, or go to the gym. OPB's Bryce Dole reports.
Liability waivers are a written agreement that you won't sue a facility for negligence in the case of an accident. The waivers are used in states throughout the Pacific Northwest, but not Oregon. That's because of a 2014 state Supreme Court ruling that invalidated those waivers. Since the ruling, recreation and fitness facilities say their liability insurance premiums have increased. Ski resorts say it's forcing them to hike lift ticket prices. State Senator Mark Meek is proposing a bill to have Oregon recognize these waivers. The Democrat from Gladstone says outdoor recreation is becoming too expensive.
At some point, it doesn't pencil out for ordinary Oregonians to go out and participate in these activities. They can't afford it.
Opponents say such waivers risk injured customers giving up their rights to go to court and show that a business acted negligently. I'm Bryce Dole, reporting.
Gas prices have dropped to an average of under $3 a gallon nationally, which is the lowest since May of 2021. But in the Northwest, those changes are less pronounced. According to the American Automobile Association, Idaho's gas prices remained at $3.25 December 2nd, with Washington at $4.16 and Oregon averaging $3.76. AAA reports we could see prices go down even lower as winter sets in. Three affordable housing projects in Pacific County are on the cusp of receiving hundreds of thousands of dollars in county funding. The funding would come from a new 0.1% sales tax passed by commissioners that went into effect in 2024. Revenue generated by the Pacific County tax must be used to support the construction, rehabilitation, and acquisition of affordable and supportive housing, as well as facilities related to mental and behavioral health. Willapa Behavioral Health and Wellness applied for about $293,000 of the funding for operations and maintenance of the Willapa Independent Housing Project. The property was recently renovated to provide supportive housing for low-income adults and those experiencing homelessness or housing instability. The Willapa Community Development Association applied for $200,000 of the funding that would go towards supporting the redevelopment of the American Legion building in Raymond. The group has been working to acquire and demolish the existing structure in order to construct a new three-story building for affordable housing that would give priority to veterans. It would also house a community resource center and a new Raymond City Hall. And Coastal Community Action Program applied for $37,000 that would support a proposed renovation of a building in Raymond that would also offer affordable housing. The Pacific County Commission could vote to formally approve the funding for all three projects at a meeting next week. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer. Read more online at chinookobserver.com. An understudied substance called kratom could soon be banned from Spokane convenience stores. If it is, Spokane would be the first city in Washington to regulate kratom in any way. Spokane Public Radio's Eliza Billingham has more.
Kratom is a plant from Southeast Asia. In small doses, it can have mood-lifting effects like caffeine. In larger doses, those effects become opioid-like. It's currently unregulated by the Federal Drug Administration, and in Spokane, anyone of any age can buy it. Mayor Lisa Brown proposed a kratom ban this week in collaboration with the police department and the West Spokane Wellness Partnership. Sarah McNew is its coalition coordinator.
These products are being marketed all throughout the community to youth. This is a billboard directly kitty-corner to North Central High School, and youth have access to walk in and buy kratom right off the shelves.
But Councilmember Michael Cathcart asked whether kratom could be considered a way to help people fight fentanyl addiction.
I know that psilocybin, for example, is one such thing that has been used and experimented with as a way to try to find another strategy to kill the fentanyl abuse. And I'm worried that as we ban things, that we take away an opportunity to study something that might truly be very beneficial.
There's little data on kratom-involved deaths, since kratom doesn't show up on typical toxicology reports. Council will vote on the proposed ban in coming weeks. I'm Eliza Billingham, reporting.
Indigenous advocates wanted to find out data about domestic violence and traumatic brain injuries among Native women, but they came up empty-handed. Now, the Urban Indian Health Institute in Washington State wants Indigenous people around the country to help fill that gap in knowledge. Owen Henderson has more.
In previous surveys, nearly 85% of Indigenous women and girls reported experiencing violence. Research shows many abusers intentionally inflict head trauma to cause memory loss and avoid visible marks. Despite this, Urban Indian Health Institute Director Abigail Echohawk says the connection between violence and TBIs in Native women hasn't been studied nationally. The federal government has slashed funding for research related to marginalized groups, so Echohawk is directing her own survey.
There is a reason I am doing this study without any resources, and my organization is self-funding this. And that is because we cannot expect that they would give us the resources to be able to do a quality research study on this specific problem.
Once the survey is complete next month, Echohawk says her organization will use the findings to push for health policy changes and greater access to resources for survivors. I'm Owen Henderson reporting.
A report from Chelan County Nonprofits finds that wildfire emissions are the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the county. NWPB's Renee Diaz speaks to one group that managed the findings.
When large fires sweep through Chelan County, they burn thousands of acres and fill the air with smoke. According to a report published this summer, wildfires account for nearly 60% of the county's total emissions. In 2023 alone, wildfires released four times the amount of greenhouse gases that came from either energy use or transportation.
The danger to all the smoke that's in the air that then is going to affect our health because we're breathing that in.
That was Marlene Farrell with Sustainable NCW. That's a local environmental education nonprofit. Farrell hopes the report can be used to secure state and federal funding for wildfire education. I'm Renee Diaz reporting.
You're listening to KMUN News. If you have a news tip or story idea, get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN News team. That includes me, host and producer Skylar Butenchen, news intern Sylvia Thorpe, and news director Katie Frankowitz. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening. Thanks for listening. The Ship Report with Joanne Rideout is coming up next.